matter of telecommunication, just as the wheelchair is also being busy with communication. And then the other apology from Mr. Bengu. Mr. Bengu from IFP, his mother passed away. So those are the three apologies that I have. And just before we continue, I just want to make a short announcement. I'm from the strategy committee this morning. We were discussing the question, as you know, the bills that were before us are supposed to be presented in the plenary on Thursday. And they've given us the time allocated for each of the bills, 30 minutes. In which case, then I would like the all other parties that would like to say something on the bill to give me their names and speak up so that I can submit them to the proper committee. And so I think that's it for the bill. I think we should allow the delegation to introduce themselves and ourselves also, therefore to introduce ourselves to them. Over to you, Professor Fan.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you. I'm Michael Khan. I head up the group known as the Center for Science, Technology and Innovation Indicators in the Human Sciences Research Council. In fact, we are neighbors of yours because we work from directly across the road in the St. Park building. Shall I introduce my colleagues? Well, on my right is Julian Rumbelow. He's in charge of the business sector for the R&D survey. On my left is Michael Gasper, who works alongside Julian on that. Behind me, on my right, first, is Natalie Klossman, who's responsible for the higher education sector, as well as looking at the non-profit organization. And on her right is Cheryl Moses, who is an anchor person in the Innovation Survey. We would have liked to have had the researcher responsible for the Science Council and Government, but she sends her apologies. That's Dr. Maloche. Thank you.
There's someone. Introduce yourself, then.
Hello, Mushi Masisi. I'm the parliamentary liaison from Serbian Economy. Serbian Economy.
Okay. So for those who do not know me, I'm Ngabani Babu. I became the acting chair. I'm no longer the chair here. I'm now a bit, but I'm acting here because we're still doing the handover. The chairperson, the new chairperson is attending, is acting also on communications portfolio committee. So they are still processing some bills there. I've got here the committee secretary, the man, and I've got the secretary, everybody, my secretary, everybody, Walter, and I'll allow other members to introduce themselves.
Stuart Kerr from the Democratic Alliance.
Sophie Marche from the Democratic Alliance.
Nefara Walter from Azarpo.
Isma Mohammed from ANC in this committee.
This is Nova, ANC.
So my member of the committee.
I and at the back there we've got the HSRC representative, the CSIR representative, parliamentary representative, Autism Frederick. There you go. I think we can go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Today, we're going to present to you what we've learnt about our country's system of innovation from the perspective of innovation and research and development. And given today's date, there's really only one way to start, and that's by making two observations. The first is that something like 40 years ago, hijackers commandeered four airliners and forced the pilots to fly them to Jordan. Many people have forgotten about that very famous incident. And in the same September month, of course, 6 years ago, hijackers commandeered four airliners, and the crucial difference, why I draw to your attention, is that they were able to program those airliners to do the dirty deed they did. And what has made this possible is the information and telecommunications revolution that we are still living through. This is an unfolding technological revolution as profound as that of the steam engine or the electric generator. We still don't see where it will end. The same ICT revolution takes us towards the knowledge economy, in which the ability to innovate is critical. The knowledge economy, in our understanding, can be understood, particularly from the perspective of innovation, by considering five different aspects, and that's what I'm going to do in this talk to you today. The knowledge infrastructure, knowledge workers, the output, the way that knowledge is transferred, and then what are known as framework conditions, which is very much the work of a committee such as yourself. In terms of knowledge infrastructure, what we think about here is the research and education system. And perhaps the most important picture to convey to you is this graph, which shows the expenditure, the growth expenditure on research and development as a percentage of GDP over time. In the booklet that you've all received, you'll find the same picture. We go back to 1983, because the measurement of R&D in South Africa has a very, very long history. It goes back to the 60s. And you'll see that the graph kind of follows almost like a bucket shape. We've got one point over there where it's a lot higher. And in our mythology, previously that was recorded as just over 1%. The reason it's below 1%, it's now 0.83, is because Statistics South Africa adjusts GDP from time to time. So on this depiction, we have never broken through the 1% barrier. That's important. You will see over there on the right the most recent figure, which is 0.92%, and that was obtained for the survey period of 2005-06. And government has set the target of 1% for the survey period 2008-09. And all things being equal, if our growth is maintained, you can imagine a straight line going up, and we are likely to meet the 1% target, possibly even a year earlier than intended. So that's very, very good news. If one tries to explain why the graphic has the shape it does, it's very difficult, because in two survey periods where there should have been surveys, this one and this one, no official survey was done. And also what happened in this period here, before the HSRC took over the job, which is there, 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 and there, the conduct of the survey migrated across three different agencies. And when that migration happens, it's very, very difficult to maintain consistency. We've been the people responsible through this period, and we've been detecting a steady increase. The military slowdown that's often given as the reason for the decline actually happened some years before the decline. In my personal view, I don't think that's the full explanation for why it dropped down. It's possibly much more a measurement issue than an actual expenditure issue. Also through this period, our country has moved through a state of negative or even zero growth into the low growth period up to the end of the 90s, and now we're into a medium growth period. And interestingly enough, the graph goes up. Whether you want to relate those two statements is up to you. The second one to look at is where is the expenditure occurring. Again, you'll find this covered in the booklet. The largest performer of R&D in the country is the business sector, combined with the not-for-profit sector. And the universities and the government sector, including the science council, are roughly equal in size. We'll say a little bit more about that as we go. What is the expenditure attributed to? In which particular research fields does it go? Well, you can see that engineering sciences and ICT and the applied sciences and technology, to add all of those up, they account for the greatest bulk of the research expenditure. That's the work of the mining companies, it's the work of Denel, it's the work of Eskom and the Pebble Jet and so on. And then you've got the natural sciences, which stands at 21%, and that's largely what's going on in the universities, along with medical and health sciences in the universities and the MRC. And here we have the social sciences at 12%, and a much smaller amount going to agricultural sciences. That pattern hasn't changed very much over the years. The country has a very strong focus on research in engineering, ICT, and technology. Now, what comes out of all of this research? Well, the conventional measure is scientific publications. And I've borrowed this table from a man called Albuquerque, who works in Brazil, and he did a very good study on Brazil, India, Mexico, and South Africa. And what is given here, to understand what the meaning of the numbers is, this shows fields in which South Africa has got a research concentration. Any number bigger than 2 represents a particular strength. The value of this table is that it shows you over a 10-year period which particular fields we have maintained our strength in, and in which particular fields we may have lost strength. You can see at the top this figure of 8, which puts us in world class. We've retained our world class strength in geology, petroleum and mining engineering. Go straight across. The animal sciences, which is largely the work of the ARC and the University of Pretoria and Magunta, has come up slightly from 3.8 to 4.4. Entomology and pest control, which again goes to the heart of our strength in agriculture, we've come up. Philosophy, interestingly, has rocketed up, and perhaps that's a product of all of the constitutional development in the country. But notice on the left, where we had a strength in inorganic and nuclear chemistry, it's disappeared. That's the decline that took place around the Atomic Energy Corporation, and that is now being rebuilt around NEXA. We've retained strength in general and internal medicine, and there it is, but it has fallen a little bit. So, one important message coming through there, where are our strengths, and how do these strengths relate to intentions around, for example, the 10-year plan? Now you might ask, where is the strength concentrated? You know that we have 5 research universities, and this is looking at universities whose publications are being cited by their peers internationally. It's taken from work done by Puri, who works out of the University of Pretoria, and you see that there are 7 fields in which, I think it's 9 fields in which our universities are seen to excel internationally. That is a measure of the volume of our papers that have been cited as worthwhile references by peers internationally. In clinical medicine, UCT is in rank 1, and this is in rank 1. So those are world-class institutions in that field. If you rank 2, that's Pretoria, Natal, and Stellenbosch Medical Schools. When you go below two, you're beginning to weaken, and if you're at a four level, you're in danger of disappearing off the radar screen. So we have some strength in engineering concentrated in Pretoria and the Zanesrand. Interestingly, not at UCT, not producing enough volume to be visible. This is not to say that the catalysis work there is inferior. It's not, it's world-class work, but it isn't producing enough volume to be noticed in this particular way of understanding where the strengths lie. Social sciences, UCT. This Natal. Remember, these are measures of citation volume. This particular picture needs quite a bit of explanation. It comes out of work that we did for NACI comparing South Africa to the countries of the European Union. The European Union is our major trading partner, and it was thought to be useful to benchmark ourselves in terms of science performance against the European Union. What you have here, running up the vertical axis, is the amount of expenditure in the universities as a proportion of GDP. And along the horizontal axis, you've got expenditure by the government research institutions as a percentage of GDP. Let me first explain in whose company we find ourselves. There's South Africa. And we dwell in the same house as Slovakia, Lithuania, Cyprus, Latvia. That's Ireland over there, and there's Portugal. Hungary, Czechoslovakia, can't remember the SI, excuse me. That's Germany, France. Sweden is an outlier. It's all on its own up there, because in Sweden, they spend a huge amount of money in their universities and virtually nothing in government research labs. This line here represents the line where you're spending an equal amount on either side. Now, I see a copy in the room of the assessment of our innovation system that was done by the OECD. And this is a quote from that OECD review, which argues that to increase knowledge-intensive production, you need to grow business research activity, but you have to also move the universities along with that. In other words, if we were to follow that advice, South Africa would move up that line there into the company of Belgium, the United Kingdom, and Spain. That would require a huge amount of investment in the universities. Probably to take the university expenditure to double what it is now. And it's a question for the policymaker. Do we want to go that route, or do we want to stay along this path, like Germany and France, where you're spending roughly equal amounts and you're maintaining a very strong science base under direct government supervision? It's a key question from the perspective of the developmental state, because it talks very strongly to the role of government. Now, where does the money come from? Government is putting in 5.4 billion rand of the total 14 billion. That's a big contribution, but a much larger contribution is coming from business, which is 6.2 billion, as well as from foreign sources, 1.9 billion. That is mainly foreign business investing in South Africa. It works out to around 14% of our total. So there's an inflow coming from abroad to do research in South Africa by the subsidiaries of foreign companies. That's normal. It happens all over the world. One can have a debate as to what size it might be or should be. At the moment, by world standards, it's relatively modest. In the United States, that figure is 30%. In Ireland, it's 80%. In Denmark, about 20%.
As long as it's not going to be the exposition, if we have one, two,
depends where the money comes from. If the money originates abroad, it would be in there. Thank you. It's a fairly complicated picture. It's in the booklet that we've distributed. There are perhaps one or two other things that are worth noticing. One is this line that goes to R317. It's not a roadmap. The 317 million rand that goes from business to higher education. That's a relatively high percentage. If you look internationally, that puts us on the high end of a direct contribution from business to higher education. Some of that is contract work, and some of it is student support. But let me move on. I think I may be going to lose out on time. The next issue to think about is who does the work. You can't expand the science system without having more researchers. And that is a summary of the present situation that we have. A total headcount of 39,000. And you have to now make an adjustment for the amount of time that people spend on research work. In universities, it's maybe a day a week. In the science councils, it should be closer to full time. So when you adjust for full time equivalent, that comes down to roughly 29,000. And the use of full time equivalents, again, that's an international standard approach. This is full time personnel. But when you look at the core, the researchers who do the work, is 17,000. Of those, the male to female ratio is 61 to 39. By world standards, that's high. In Japan, it would be 91 to 9. In Argentina, it's roughly 50-50. In Russia, it's roughly 50-50. This has come up just a little bit in the period we've been measuring, when we started out with 37. The next statistic is the proportion of black and white researchers. In our first survey in 2001, there were 21% black researchers in the system. Today that has risen, and that's 5 years later, to 33%. So there is distinct movement, and it is mainly that the proportion of whites has gone down, and within this, the proportion of African researchers has gone up quite strongly. So policy is having an effect, and that's what's happened over the 4 year period. The quality of the research workforce is conventionally measured by the proportion of those with a doctorate, and we seem to have 22% of our researchers with doctorates. A note here just for the moment, this is in the context of a massive expansion in higher education, and part of that expansion is an increasing number of PhD graduates. We've broken through the 1,000 marks already in 2004. And the PhDs have to go on to become researchers in industry and the future professors. When you look at this knowledge stock by international standards, we are low. We have 1.5 full-time equivalent researchers for every 1,000 of the employed workforce. Argentina is at 2.3. China is the same as us, but it's a very, very much larger population. So they can talk about hundreds of thousands of researchers. We have 10,000, 17,000. Where are these smart people? And you'll see an immediate relationship between that slide I had earlier about where the citations are concentrated. If we use the NRF scientist rating scheme, then you come down very quickly to UCT, which has 21 A-rated scientists, and that begins to explain why it is in world rank for clinical medicine and social science. And you see the concentration drops significantly. This has 12 A-rated scientists, Stellenbosch 9, Pretoria 3, KwaZulu-Natal 4. So these are the stars of the system that are reckoned to be in world class and would be recognized as such anywhere that they went. I mentioned earlier the massive expansion of the higher education system. The number of students has more or less doubled
over the last 10 years. But there's an alarm bell here, there's a red flag, and thanks to Natalie, my colleague there, we have a nice picture which shows you in red the number of full-time equivalent research staff in the universities. And you can see over the period of time it's remaining flat. So we want to grow the universities, we want to produce more PhDs, but we do not have an increasing number of researchers in there, and that's a serious problem. In terms of the output from all of this investment and all of these clever people, we have the results of the innovation survey, which some of you may be familiar with, and we find that South African firms, through this internationally comparable survey, rate themselves at the same level as Denmark and Ireland. It's quite a high figure. It compares very well with an earlier unofficial survey done by the University of Pretoria a few years ago. So our firms believe they are innovative. It doesn't mean that they're producing things that are new to the world, but they are doing things that are new to the local market, and that's how you make profit. When you look at new to the market, they say that something like 10.1% of their activities is new to the market, and that compares very well with a small country system like that in Denmark or Spain. So we're definitely not laggard when it comes to innovation. A third one to look at is where the companies are spending their money to drive innovation, and again, our behavior is fairly normal. Most of the expenditure is acquisition of machinery, equipment, and software, and that is always much greater than expenditure on R&D. This is the risky stuff. Here you can invest with greater confidence because you're importing a machine, you're setting up a machine to do something that you've got a good understanding of. Very important in innovation is who you work with. And here two South African firms share a common behavior with their peers abroad. The major source of innovation activity comes from clients and customers. They say that we want something different, and you start thinking about how you can meet that demand. There is also a huge relationship with suppliers, but a very much smaller one with universities and the science council. And this is also typical around the world. We're not doing something wrong here. We're not messing up. Stay close to your customer is usually the advice that you give to a business that's trying to grow. And that's what our firms seem to be doing. Part of the innovation output is patenting. Now this is a slightly complicated picture, but it can be interpreted quite simply. What we've got going up here is what might be called patenting efficiency. It's how many patents you produce for the expenditure on research. That's going up there, and along here as well. And it's interesting to plot these out and see what emerges. Down here are China, Turkey, Brazil, and Romania, those four countries. Up there, Ireland, Singapore, and Austria. Singapore is often chosen as an example of a country where patenting is rocketing through the ceiling. Where are we? We're in the company of Mexico, Chile, that's South Africa. And interestingly enough, we are above this line. And what that says to you is we're doing somewhat better than our country wealth would suggest we would do. In other words, our patenting output is not atypical given our standard of wealth. It's often said that we're doing very, very badly, but by international standards, we're not doing that badly, according to this analysis. When you look at the actual patents that are coming out, and you look at our world rank, you begin to get some confirmation. This is Sasol over there, the Fisher Trough. They are ranked in this field of patenting, we're fourth in the world. In the case of metallurgy, and that's mining and Mintec, and all the big names that you know, we are 12th in the world. The separation processes that are key to mining, the number 17, and even moving the bits and pieces around the mine, we're number 18. However, when you come to the area that might drive pharmaceuticals, we very, very much love. But this begins to suggest that the depression about our low patenting volume may be overdone. There are particular strengths that we should be proud of. And you pick it up again. If I go way, way back to the beginning of the presentation and just take you to agricultural sciences, 6.8%. And then I take you to this picture and you see animal agriculture there. Now we ask ourselves, what comes out of all of that research? The answer is in this particular picture. Plant breeders' rights. We are number 5 in the world. That is a sustained strength, and it comes because the amount of expenditure on agricultural research and development in relationship to the share of agriculture in our GDP is high by world standards and has been high for many, many years. That's why we have food security.
That contradicts then, Professor, the original trend of funding going down in agricultural research compared to, I think it was 205, 206. And I realize also that your statistics reflecting those patterns there in that second graph there was basically 201, I think. So within 5 years, we've actually gone down. And yet you say that our, you know, in terms of our ranking, we are up. That just seems to me a little bit of a contradiction.
I take your point. The change here is very, very small. It maybe contains a little warning sign, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're falling through the floor. And secondly, in this picture, you can see we've pulled up.
So that's 2001.
In 2001, yes. I don't have current figures for this.
I wonder if, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Sorry, one thing question. Would that have the same, what White said so far in the morning, I think, the drop in production now, if there are no factors?
I'll see. I would hesitate to offer a definite answer. I think there are many factors at work around that problem. I don't think it would come out in a direct way from the data that I'm presenting here. But it certainly must be a concern. Knowledge transfer. I've already said something about the extent to which our firms interact with their suppliers and their customers. What's interesting, however, is when you look at research and development collaboration. Now, let me explain what this one shows. In the previous survey and in the one that we're still processing, we asked firms a very simple question. Tell us, do you have research collaboration with a local university, a science council, a foreign university, a foreign company? And we were surprised at the very large proportion that said they did. These research collaborations are alive and well in South Africa. And in the survey we're about to take to the field, we're going to explore that in much more detail. So when you have a look at our local companies, that's the black line, you see that something like 60% claim to have a research collaboration with a local university. In other words, this idea that the universities are isolated, they do their own blue sky stuff, and we in industry are deprived and we don't get any benefit, doesn't seem to be borne out by the evidence. It's an important finding. What's even more interesting is that the foreign firms, these ones in purple, even a higher percentage of them claim to have a research collaboration with our local universities. So there's definitely something positive happening there. When you look at our firms collaborating with science councils, well, in black, our local firms seem to have a greater affinity for our local science councils than the foreign firms. And then, of course, when you look at what's happening abroad, you find that foreign firms relate more to their foreign parents than we do, because we don't have foreign parents. We're purely domestic. So there's an interesting message in this radar diagram, or spiderweb diagram, the research collaborations do take place much more than that previous picture, this one, which shows the universities and the science council at the bottom for innovation instead of research and development. Now, moving to conclusion, the framework conditions are the factors that make research possible. And from the perspective of firms and possibly even the universities, one has to be conscious that doing R&D is a risky business. I have some data on this slide taken from a Canadian study that looked at 1,100 Canadian patents or inventions. 75 reached the market, 6 were blockbusters. That is 0.6% or 0.5%. And 45 of those, of course, the market lost money. It gives you a feeling for risk. Invention in R&D is inevitably risky. You don't always know what's going to come out the far end. And I like to joke about the South African electronics industry. If you ask what was the value of the research done on radar in the CSIR in the 50s and 60s, the answer is tonight when you turn on your DSTV, that box, the electronics in there, has origins in those organizations. So the benefit can appear many, many years later. Prepayment technology comes out of military technology. We might not like prepayment technology, but there is a distinct research benefit there. Now, the actual framework conditions. Minister Manuel takes care of this. Minister Ngalana takes care of that. Availability of finance, that's a matter for the banks and venture capital. Why will firms engage in R&D and try to take it to the next stage? What blocks them? It's often the probability of venture capital, and that's what the Technology Innovation Agency is going to try and address. Intellectual property rights, I believe the committee is still deliberating the bill that CST has brought on the way that publicly funded R&D should have its intellectual property protected. The mechanisms for commercialization, that's what the TIA will be about. And then we have two very important areas. Direct incentives, the support program for industrial innovation, the technological human resources, the industry program, the innovation fund, and the biotechnology regional innovation center. These all provide grant finance. The total coming into the system there is around $400 million a year. Relatively small. It can help, but it's a relatively small amount of money. The indirect incentives, if the R&D tax allowance works, here you're talking about 1.4 billion rand contribution. So it will absolutely dwarf what is being incentivized directly. And the second last slide I have is just to speculate a little bit. How does all of this hang together? How does it relate to the 10-year plan that the department is busy scoping? One of the themes in the 10-year plan is the farmer to pharmaceutical value chain. Now, just speculated a little bit about the various components that already exist that can give substance to such a value chain now. I'm not looking to the future, to the far future, where genomic testing, sequencing the genes of everyone in the room is likely to be possible. I'm just thinking about the here and now. Where are our strengths at the present time? And I make the point at the bottom. Making all of this happen depends critically on ICTs and computing power. And that takes me back to my opening theme about the ICT revolution. It permeates everything. So country strength in software will be very, very important. There's the bandwidth issue at the top. And in here, I've simply highlighted some of the actors who will be important. The farmer-to-farmer value chain will be impacted significantly by climate change. It also relies very, very strongly, particularly at the farmer end, on remote sensing, and that in turn connects back to the first science and technology challenge that is also in the 10-year plan. So So it hangs together very, very nicely. And in conclusion, this is what we should never forget. I haven't yet mentioned anywhere in the presentation the second economy. But the second economy walks with us throughout our daily lives. And I'll leave you that image, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I like the last part. Just keep it as a script page. Very, very nice. I like the faces that in themselves are images of another artwork. Very, very advanced. Yeah. Members, let me hear what you want to say. But before members engage with you, can you go back to a slide, sorry, of the tennis? You know, I saw something like this veterinary sign sighting as if it looked like it was going up when actually I'm expecting it to be going down. Yeah. Veterinary medicine, yeah, let's see. It was at 2.7. 2001 is 2.9. Can you verify that? Can you tell the rest so that they can see the other number? As far as I understand, there has been a decline in veterinary science development. We've had a number of even I've had some appeal even from the University of Pretoria faculty about this. Can you verify why your statistics seem to be suggesting the opposite?
I shall try, Chairperson. The important thing here, I think there are two things to say. The first is, this is 2001, as one of the members has pointed out. The second is, this is talking about publications, not people. It is quite possible that the number of deaths qualifying from the University of Pretoria has fallen. It's quite possible that the number of field deaths who've left on the work is greater than we would like it to be. But up to the year 2001, this researcher has found that the volume of research publications had actually increased in the world context. It's possible that the total number of publications in the world has declined, and South Africa's share, therefore, has gone up. So there's a number of interpretations or factors that have to be brought in before you interpret this. But it doesn't speak directly to the problem of death on the ground.
Yeah, yes, I would therefore say that we would need to know more facts before we take the statistics as informative at this juncture for instance, because indeed now it's 2007, 5 years down the line, really something might have happened. It may happen that up until 2001 the trend was exactly as it is.
Yeah.
And after that it started declining. Yeah. Okay, now it's fine. Okay. So allow members then. Can you also bring back the light? Honorable Farod, in that order.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Firstly, I wanted to ask questions on, and then I will come with my comments. The first question I wanted to ask was on a slide called publication. I see that in 1991, there was no item called education there. And all of a sudden in 2001 it appears, but it's very low. And so one wants to see how the measurement were taken. You know, the statistical data where did you pull it from all of a sudden? Yeah, it emerges from nowhere as far as the slide is concerned. And also I want to know what are the reasons why education does not have as many publications as they are. Then the other slide is the concentration of excellence. I see the universities that are here are the traditional well-funded universities. And I haven't seen a slide which shows an improvement on those that were discriminated against by the past. At least a feel of how are they doing, even if they are at zero. What we wanted to see, because our responsibility is actually to see that trend, rather than just to have those that we know will always be there. So I would like to hear from you in terms of that, as to what is happening, because we think that something is being done, and we might just leave it and think that it has been done where it is not. Then the other slide is on flood breeders' rights. I think I heard you talking about the fact that South Africa has food security. I don't think so. Because the statistics relating to poverty does not give us that particular direction. So I really want to hear from you, because then we can engage. There are more than 60% of our people are still do not have food security. Then there is the slide on industry, universities and science councils, but you were more talking about collaboration. The web that you have, is talking about collaboration. Now, what I'm asking here is what kind of collaboration? Because in terms of our new society, one would really want to see what kind of collaborations, whether by foreign companies or not, because if we don't investigate what kind of collaboration, we may end up perpetuating the past. People getting our wealth and knowledge, and it continues. So I just want to get that, and then we can engage if I feel. The other one is government support R&D because of the cannot afford. That is the last, the third last before for the other two. Innovation funds like TRIPS, STII, the Innovation Fund. Now, when I have had an experience with this fund,
yeah.
I was once an evaluator of TRIPS, and I can talk with authority that they are more often than not tilted to industry and not even to small businesses. Because small businesses in terms of TRIPS do not have the rent-to-rent requirement, and therefore they are left out most of the time, even when there are innovative ideas from this. I just want to hear your comment. But let me say something basic here. The statistics by themselves, the statistical data by themselves, depends who has kept. Because normally in statistics, you are able to present a case. Anybody who presents statistical data anywhere else in the world presents a case, and when you present a case, you tend to go and get information that relates to the case you are presenting. Now, I don't know whether that's the case here, and you can tell me. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, the court is back in session. you've put a wide range of questions to me, and I shall try to do justice to all of them. If I forget one or two, I'm sure you'll remind me.
I don't know how you want to answer them. Probably, do you want to answer them person by person, or you want to take all the questions and then answer all of them, or you want to answer thousands?
Maybe I should do those first, because there are about seven or eight. And my brain won't cope. The first question you put was around the citation, and you asked why that narrow range of universities. The explanation is simply this: in the particular way that one is counting, you're looking at volume, the volume of citations, and therefore if you're below a particular level, you won't appear. It does not mean that there are no brilliant scientists working at universities that are not on that list. So, for example, the University of Northwest has a particular strength in ophthalmology, but you won't find it on that table because the number of papers they produce is below the cutoff level. So this acts as a filter. It says if you want to compare institutions that are producing large volumes, then that's what you're going to see. So it doesn't mean that the other universities are not making progress. One would have to extend this calculation to include them, and that we have not available for you. The same explanation holds for this table. You ask, where did education come from? What it means is that in 1991, education was probably around 1.5. And the table cuts off at 2. So it didn't come from nowhere. It came from a lower level. And it has now made it just over the edge, over there. And this will reflect the fact that there's quite a lot of work going on in the field of education policy in particular, at places like UWC, and it used to be UDW, and this. So that is my reply to the first two of your questions. You then I'm beginning to lose. The other one was around food security, and that is of course a very political issue. What is being argued here is that the country has the scientific and technological capability to feed its people. In other words, it isn't a poverty of technology. It may be a poverty of politics, which is a different issue. And this is not a political presentation in the direct sense. You might engage and say the way you've constructed it is a particular political viewpoint. I would accept that. But back to what I just said, it's the poverty of politics rather than the poverty of technology. Dealing with cholera, the technology is perfectly well understood, yet we get cholera. When people get cholera in South Africa, they do not die in the same numbers as they would in West Africa or India, because we have the technology and the services to deal with it. The fact that it happens is political. The fact that we can deal with it, that's to do with services and technology. And what I'm driving at here is that the country has and retains a basic strength in agricultural science. That in and of itself doesn't deal with the issue of distribution. And then the last one was your question about there were two more. One was the question around collaboration. And you were asking what is the nature of the collaboration. In truth, we can't answer you at this stage. We have to wait for the results of the current survey to be able to answer you on that one. All we know is that it exists, but what the details are, we don't know. So we are inquiring into that. And then the last one was your comment about SRIP.
I think you would know more about CRISP than I do at this particular point in time, but looking at the evaluation of CRISP as I recently did, it's clear that CRISP has tended to operate mainly with very large companies, and that it has operated on a repeat basis. The big companies find it a useful means to use as a screen for hiring and also to develop their next batch of recruits. You're probably correct to say that very small firms can't engage because they don't have the funds. By the same token, however, the SPY program is very strongly focused on the small players and has become even more so over the last two cycles, as far as I can tell. So it might well be the case that one has incentive schemes that target different layers. This one may work better for large companies, that one may work better for small companies. Doesn't necessarily mean that each scheme will work perfectly well across the whole system. Of course, I'm not present today to make the case for SPY or for DTI, because I don't work with it. Thank you.
I think we would put some arguments more if we had time on those specific particular institutions of finance, because I've also dealt a number of times with some challenges that face them. But I think it's not the time now to discuss them. And let me allow the speaker, Mr. Farway, what's the second?
Thank you, Chair. I've been trying to analyze in my mind, you know, this whole issue about agriculture. And I'm trying to actually look at it, as I quoted it over there, in terms of what is currently on the ground. And I mean, there must have been some purpose, you know, in terms of the publications that took place between 1991 and 2001, because I would say on both sides of that point, you've got about 50% of them all being sort of agriculturally derived publications, which said something. And I was just wondering whether your research can actually reflect post-94 and pre-94 as being some of the leading guiding sort of issues that actually created that. I mean, there were sanctions in this country prior to that. Yes, maybe this whole nuclear energy, you know, sort of publication reaching the particular markets, etc. And I want you to link that maybe to your last graph, which actually shows the opportunity in terms of farmers to farmers. And in that respect, you know, I think that the opportunity in terms of the same publications, agriculture, should be increasing even more, particularly with climate change. And I'm just wondering whether in fact there is that momentum in reality on the ground, knowing what's happening, where we were previously, you know, we had self-sufficiency, we were net exporters of agricultural products, and now a lot of it's been imported. And that should really dictate the research as to where it should be going to. It's something one would assume would be a comparative advantage, and that one would leak into that. So I just wanted your comments there, Professor, as to, you know, whether those are the actual guiding principles. Do we have to have, you know, droughts and everything else in the country before we actually start getting universities and research institutions to start looking at some of the, you know, the aspects of it, particularly, you know, in terms of genetically modified products in the production side? And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, if we look at South Africa today, we seem to be running a battle, and it's all linked to climate change, of fossil energy versus, you know, the nuclear energy. And I don't see, other than in 1991, when we were trying to make a nuclear bomb in this country for some reason or other, very much sort of our direction going that way in that particular publication, particularly in respect of pebble bed, you know, reactors and things of that nature, and knowing the shortage of energy that we are facing in the next 5 years. So I just wanted you to give me some guidance as to whether, you know, those are the driver, let's put it on research, and whether climate change is possibly not the biggest one that we should be looking into, and particularly gas with energy as well. Thank you.
The point was made that statistics may be employed in many different ways. Lies, damned lies, and statistics, that famous old phrase. But the statistics that have been presented here, I believe, are serving the purpose that we had in mind, in that it's provoking a particular conversation about where we might be going. And the member has made, I think, a very strong and correct point, is that technology evolves in response to particular drivers. Now, I like to joke and ask the question, how many light bulbs does it take to change Eskom? We all know the light bulb joke. This is the light bulb joke the other way around. How many light bulbs does it take to change Eskom? The answer is 5.3 million. That's the number of light bulbs they gave away in the Western Cape 2 winters ago. And what I'm getting at is your question about climate change and fossil fuels and nuclear. We might be asking ourselves why, given our abundant sunlight and our long coastline and our windy cities, Port Elizabeth is called the windy city, why is it that South Africa has got absolutely no footprint whatsoever in renewable energy? And that would take me back to my response to you, sir. It's all about politics. It was not important to a particular sector to go renewable. But we should be world leaders in renewables. Currently, I think there's 3 tiny little windmills up the road on the West Coast. You could have gone to the United States 25 years ago and you would have seen hundreds in operation. We told you can't have windmills up the road because of the birds. And my answer to that is, please, you're talking nonsense. There's no country more bird conscious than the Netherlands, and it's covered in windmills. So these are political, economic, social, values questions. What particular path will you take with your technology? Climate change, undoubtedly, to listen to David King, is one of the big issues for the next generations to come. And that will almost certainly drive and stimulate research in agriculture. There is a particular group at UCT specializing in genetically modified drought-resistant crops. That will be important. But the genetic revolution which is upon us will be as important as the ICT revolution, perhaps in 20 years' time. And there's a lot we cannot predict in that field. But I'm agreeing with you that technology gets driven by factors outside technology. Thank you.
I think whichever of the best, and there is another hand there from Honorable Henson.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll let you. Really, thank you for the presentation. I think this point that you mentioned about what the elements may concern for us, I think we know now, namely that today the most technologically advanced economies are actually on the face of the second slide in the presentation. My question, if you look, for instance, at the Doha round, currently under discussion at the conference, and
Thank you very much. To deal with your questions in reverse order, just given what's on the screen, the framework programs of the European Union, it's now Framework Program 7, they don't appear on this list because they are not local framework conditions. So that is something outside. The fact that we as a country are doing quite well in engaging with the European Union programs and with researchers in Europe, that's a compliment. The fact that we can access and we're doing quite well compared to other emerging economies. So there's some good news in there, and this is also a compliment to the DST staff and their contact points in the various institutions in the country who've worked very hard to make that happen. So it is outside our framework conditions. It's a product of our system that we can do it. And where the financial flow would appear, it would appear in that box called foreign coming in. Okay. Your question about the trade negotiations in Doha, that, I think, fits into the same category as the question from a member, Darrow, that depending on the outcome, we may respond by saying, well, we can deal with this challenge through a particular technology approach. If we go back to Denmark, Denmark 100 years ago was a land of milk and wheat. They were food producers. They relied heavily for their survival on farming and selling agricultural products with no value added to speak of across their borders. Denmark today is one of the most wealthy, equitable societies on earth. How did they do it? They moved up the value chain, and this is how I'm answering your question about Doha, because their exports are not just milk and cheese, but it's food processing machinery. Same is true in Finland. Finland was all about trees, but Finland is also about the machinery that allows you to manage forestry plantations. What about South Africa? South Africa is about mines and holes in the ground, but we also produce a particular set of mining engineering products. We're not known globally for that, but that does exist. We don't export the very, very big, heavy machinery because we don't make it. And in our particular industrial environment, what we are not is a heavy engineering country. Yesterday I had a discussion with someone from VTI about the NIPF, and he was asking, well, how are we going to supply this, this, and this to ESCOM? And my answer to this very smart person was, well, there are only four or five places in the world where you can source generators. We don't make them. And if it's a huge pressure vessel, you've got to go to Mitsubishi in Japan to buy it, because we have never, ever produced those. There's a size limit that we have not passed. Had we gone Korean and built a shipbuilding industry, we might have the technique to do it, but we don't have it. So one has to interrogate very carefully where you have competence and where you've got a competitive advantage and how you can possibly build that step by step. So that's what the Danes did, and they may be able to learn something from that.
There seems to be very little research and development here for the second economy.
Can you take it up
and geared towards uplifting the poor? For example, in these kinds of presentations, one is very seldom is referred to research being done, for example, in cheap, sustainable provision of water, cheap, sustainable sanitation, cheap energy. A lot of research seems to be done on agriculture. But then I can't see, I have a huge rural constituency. I search in vain for the application of all of this research that has been done on agriculture, the application of that research into my constituency. Related to that, I don't think we're going to have much on IT revolution. If it is focused
from Leningrad University, on the wealthy, on urban areas. We've got this, what gets them paid to ensure that the urban poor, the rural poor, are brought into IT. Because God may get in my constituency, 250,000 people. In maybe some territory, at some clinics, in some schools, with virtually no telco communication because there's no network. And so why don't you bring these people, vast hundreds of thousands of people, into this IT revolution? Where do you make it to make it general success and to complete the rest of the world? The second question is in one of your earlier slides, you indicated that foreign firms are investing in R&D in South Africa. And I was wondering if the opposite is also true. Are we as South Africans, an African firm, are they also investing in R&D at all? And if they are, what kind of thing?
Easier for me again to start in reverse order because I think I know some of the answers. To some of the other questions I don't have an answer. Are South African firms conducting R&D abroad? Answer is yes. Some of it is publicly acknowledged and you can read about it very easily. If you visit the Sasol website, you will see that they are funding a research program at the University of St Andrews in Scotland. Why there? It's North Sea oil, and there's some smart people they want to benefit from. De Beers, many years ago, set up a lab for artificial diamonds in Ireland. Other South African firms, particularly in ICT, and I won't name them, are doing research in India and other countries. It's relatively small. I think SAPI also has a research facility in Germany. And it's possible Sasol's got some smaller ones, but these things are not directly reported to us when you do the survey work, and you pick it up from looking at annual reports and trawling through the internet. So it is happening. Your question about what R&D is being done that addresses the needs of the poor, whether it is in terms of technological solutions or social solutions. Those questions should be answered by our fellow science councils. I can only speak on behalf of the HSRC, but the CSIR has programs that it will tell you about, and the same is true of the ARC, and indeed of MINTEC with its small mining programs. So they will say, yes, we are in the business of making that difference. I return to my point earlier. In many cases, the technology is very, very well known. You don't have to do new research. What you have to research is how, in heaven's name, can we get it to work in this community? Are they going to be happy to push a barrel of water? Or what people really want is, like you and I, to turn on a tap. And that's often the barrier that the technology has to cross because it isn't meeting the expectations of the person who wants the service. The ICT issue is very, very similar. I will stick my neck out and say that the technology that's had the greatest impact on improving the quality of life of South Africans has been the cell phone. And the penetration of the cell phone, we all know. Back in 1995, when we first purchased our brick, the estimate was the total market would be 250,000 phones owned by people with an income level, I don't know how it goes, LSM 1 or 2. And the reality is there are more than 20 million of these things clustering up our lives. So the example you give, you shouldn't be having to say that. There should be coverage everywhere. But more than anything else, and that's a technology that has changed lives. And I could even add, it's a technology that South African science has contributed to.
Vodacom claims that the successful software engineering of pay-as-you-go technology was their innovation. It started in Portugal, they couldn't get it right. South African software engineers got it right. So we can blame ourselves that the phones are everywhere in the world. The issue of improving the lives of the poor. When the poor don't eat, the rich don't sleep, you know. And that is something that has to come through much more strongly in science policy, indeed in the 10-year plan. And again, I'm not paid by BST to advocate their policy, but you have grand challenge number 5, the human and social dynamics. That is being scoped out in collaboration with HSRC and others to address the very concerns that you are expressing. It won't show up in this kind of graphic. The pro-poor policy you will find happening in the social sciences and humanities research field. But whether those advocating pro-poor policy are listened to in the corridors of power, that is another question. And that is not my job to argue for that. No, I cannot account for why there were no official surveys done in those two particular years. In the case of 1995, there was a process known as the National Research and Technology Audit that included a survey component, but the survey was felt to have gone about its work in ways that made the results incompatible with previous surveys. So it was not included as an official figure. Why there was no survey in 2000, I'm afraid only the Director General of the time could answer that. Your next question was, do foreign firms apply conditions to the inward flow of funds? If it's a foreign firm, I think I would be correct in saying no, because it is going from parent to subsidiary company. So it's a company transfer. If it's coming from a donor foundation, for example, Wellcome Trust or Ford Foundation, yes, it will have conditions. And those are to do with good governance, and that the money should be spent on what people said they wanted it for. But I hope that answers the question in the way that you were posing it. On the PhDs, that number of 1,000, just over 1,000 nearly 1,100. That has gone up quite strongly in the last few years. The department is talking about that figure going up fivefold, which is a noble goal. One needs to bear in mind also that there is quite a significant foreign student component in that number, around 20%, mainly from Africa, and that these highly skilled PhD graduates then leave the country and almost certainly go off to Europe or America. We don't believe they go home to stay there. In other words, the true number of South African nationals is a little bit lower than what that figure tells you, and as we've been seeing, everything has to have some interpretation attaching to it. The last question, are we succeeding in bridging the gap? I'm scared to answer that. Again, if you go to the people in the economics departments, they will give you this device that measures income inequality, the Gini coefficient. And I will say to you, actually, what has happened in the last 10 years is that it has widened, not narrowed. The answer, I think, lies in it depends who you ask, where you stand. Thank you.
Well, I also have a right to also ask questions. I can't be deprived total. At least once. Yeah, I think I have some few questions myself. First, I want to emphasize a very important point that you raised, that technology is politically driven. If you look at different economies that once were down, went up, and some were up, went down, all that when you follow up, you find that it was actually the consequence of political direction. We have had some professors there from the University of Pretoria giving us a course on innovation management and research management. I think we learned a lot from those few courses that they offered to us. But one of the things that they stressed there, which I have found, and in fact in many other platforms that I have happened to find myself in or interacting with, I've always found a totally different or contrary view than what they told us. They told us that ICT in particular, they said when they were showing us the innovation chain from research and development right up to the market output, that actually South Africa always says things, or many people advocate that South Africa is on top of ICT. In reality, it is only on top of the marketing part of ICT. When it comes to indigenous research and development, ICT is an important thing for South Africa. I want you to then come in because you gave an example of Vodacom. And then you said you are doing very well. And I just want you to come and substantiate so as some of the members who attended the course will remember or recollect very well what exactly we were told on that particular course program in terms of ICT. My second question is about the research, the citing index that you gave. Does this index take into consideration individual, for instance, individual that is acting outside the institution as an output of international publication. And if so, what can you tell us? Of course, some one of the very important institutions in the United States, which usually capture the some bad success from individuals of the world, which is called Marcus, like, who is in the world. You know about what criteria and how far that particular is conformed to what you have shown me. In terms of nuclear science and engineering, you had some nuclear chemistry thing, of course. Nuclear chemistry is not exactly directly part of nuclear power, of course, although it forms some components. If you think about, of course, water chemistry as part of nuclear training program. But nuclear chemistry, as far as I am advanced here in South Africa, I have not seen it as very developed as I've seen in the world. I wonder if I'm making a mistake. But I think nuclear chemistry is not to me, very developed. Chemistry is developed. Nuclear chemistry in particular, unless you do not know what we're talking about nuclear chemistry. When South Africa developed the six fission gun type device during their nuclear deterrent strategy, so when we are going to develop something like a device, if we are not collaborating, of course, most of the research, design development is done at collaboration level. But of course, you usually have the local output in terms of international publication and copyright. in terms of, therefore, nuclear science and engineering, we are supposed to have been in some kind of history to have appeared at two, if it meant that we were really developing it on our own, and why does nuclear engineering, science hasn't appeared? Does it mean that he has those devices is a result of some important know-how that gave us that know-how? And if so, why? Because that is what the proposals have always been against. In promoting nuclear engineering for weapons purposes. As one of the speakers here spoke about indigenous technologies, to alleviate poverty, India has engaged very, very much hard in developing local indigenous technologies to really make a social impact on ordinary citizens. I remember once asking with you somewhere in one of the workshops, and you said you raised some reasons that people want to take the path of China or India after 1994. But I think we can take that part without taking the exact, without actually copying everything that China and India does, but adopt such a program to suit the South African situation post 1994. I want you to comment on that. Thank you very much.
Okay, so starting at the top, the question about what is it that goes into this blob here, this column, the information, communication, and computer technology. Yes, it's true. South Africa does not have a large hardware industry. We don't. There's a highly specialized telecommunications industry, mainly around defense aerospace. A large chunk of it is in Cape Town, between the Science Park at the University of Stellenbosch, and you come down to what used to be Cape Technicon, and you go along the railway line, and you get out to Telemat in Steenberg in Retreat, and then you turn right, and you get to Omniplex and some other companies. Highly specialized, world-class competitors, but it's not generally seen in hardware. MTN and Vodacom, their entire network runs on imported boxes. And that's typical of all cell phone, most cell phone companies. So at the one end, we've got a highly specialized hardware manufacturing sector. At the other end, you've got the cell phone companies, and somewhere in between, you've got a very vast sector, the services sector, whose business activities turn upon software development. They don't produce software for sale in the marketplace. They produce software for use within their company walls. Prime example would be Old Mutual. They were only the second company in the Southern Hemisphere to have a mainframe computer installed back in around 1959. Very nice story. A lot of this expenditure, therefore, in that 13.2% is our banks, our retailers, our insurance companies spending money on software development that they keep inside the company. So it isn't strictly true to say there's no ICT industry, but a lot of it's invisible for the very reason it's happening within the companies. And it goes a long way to explain why it is that a company like Old Mutual can go out and buy the largest insurer in Scandinavia. It's why APSA could work all the way across Africa, because they've got the systems to do it and they engineered them themselves. So that is a huge country strength. Your question about the citations, those citations are derived from the databases of the Institute for Scientific Information in Philadelphia. They would have been adjusted to take account of where the person is sitting when they publish. So it is based upon properly corrected fractional and institutional counts. Your question about nuclear chemistry and nuclear engineering, I wasn't in the country in the 80s. So I don't know the story. The people who were working on nuclear weapon technology from the 60s onward, because it began in the CSIR around about 1963, they were working under conditions of secrecy. They wouldn't have been publishing. The nuclear chemistry publications that were depicted in that table, they would be areas that are safe enough to be distant from nuclear weapon technology that nobody's going to say, look, what are you up to? So it was a secret program, as we know, and I don't believe we know the full details of everything that happened either. I've lost your last question. Oh, the rural. The rural issue. It is still a surprise to me that we do not have an institute for appropriate technology in the country. Nowhere. Not at the university, not in the Science Council network. It could be set up. There are many such institutes in India, state-run NGOs. We had Gupta out here talking about his work.
We do not have that. We've relied upon the mainstream science councils to do that as part of their mandate. The members might debate whether, in fact, it is succeeding or not. That's not my task to do. But one could ask whether we need such an institution. It's possible that DSP has this in mind with the Public Benefit Foundation, but if it's inside DSP, it would be more of a funder than an implementer. And I think the issue really is implementation. It's making it happen in response to the need of a community and meeting that need. It goes back to the question of what drives technology. If it's needs-driven, you've got a chance that it will deliver the goodies. If it's driven because it's fascinating to me personally, well, that's my happy time. But it doesn't necessarily provide the dividends that you expect.
I've got more questions. There was Professor there and Mr. Blanche, and then we have him that further.
Thank you, Chair. I was not going to comment really because it might also seem really negative, but let me make the point in any case. I've had great problems. Maybe it's my eyes this morning, I'm not sure, that I cannot read any of those numbers on this document. Except on page one. But there are hardly everywhere I can make out what the numbers say. Another point I want to make really is that I always found it strange to see that I spent a number of years teaching at Wits, and every year I was asked how much time do you spend doing research. And this is always a problematic thing because I don't know. And other mathematicians I spoke to also didn't know. Put on this figure, and that's what we did. So to a great extent, it was guesswork, and the guesswork was influenced by, if I spend too much time on the research, the head of department will give me more teaching time. And so I would minimize that. Whereas when I taught in London, in the number of years, nearly 10 or 6 or so, I was not once asked to tell how much time I spent on research. And it's not just myself, but all the other people also. So I really don't know, you see, to what extent I believe some of the figures that one gets, you see, to how much extent is it guesswork, because people would say, especially the top mathematicians, I'm too busy. I cannot calculate this. I just give them any old figure. Anyhow, those are my 2 points, really. I'll read a little booklet afterwards, you see, because I've read the figure, and it may just be today that I cannot see the figures.
Well, apologies for the typography. We can provide by email the presentation, and your chair or the secretariat could print it out two to a page, in which case it will be more legible. So apologies. The question you're raising, the issue you're drawing attention to, is absolutely valid. It is extremely difficult to determine how much time a researcher spends on their research. In the case of Canada, for example, they simply borrowed the estimates, the ratios that the Americans had developed some years ago, and they apply them in Canada. They say, if you're a prof at McGill, which is a top research university, 0.6 of your time is on R&D. If you're a prof at the Algonquin Community College, it's 0.1. And that's it. No argument. In the case of South Africa, we've not gone that route. We've relied very much upon the fact that academics are required to report to the Department of Education, and it is audited what their time allocated to research is. So that is the route we've taken. We don't yet feel confident enough to say, we know that Stellenbosch is 0.2. We know that Pretoria is 0.3. We don't know that yet. That's why we are going to the universities and asking for the information directly. I think those were your two comments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
feeling a little bit worried about what the professor said, that we don't seem to be getting the assistance from officials on innovations that happen in South Africa. And I would say that it's perhaps because we are inheriting a bureaucracy that remains a bureaucracy. Whenever people come with new inventions, a bureaucrat has to look at it, and if he doesn't look at it, Portugal will take it before we do that even see. I have recently referred a company who was doing some research on water purification at the Pretoria Sewage Works to some of our departments, and 2 months later I heard that they've gone to Portugal as well, and that Portugal has given them money and they're going in. Is there not a way whereby the universities can come to us and say to our portfolio committee, you now need to either give an instruction to the HSRC or somebody in the finance department to put up a subcommittee to look at innovations and to accept innovations, scrutinize them, and then make decisions on them. I would like to take that even 1 point further. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that we as a portfolio committee have an oversight function that needs to address it as well. If we are losing innovations to other countries, we are losing future income. Is there any way whereby Professor Kahn can perhaps ask one of his students to make a survey on how we have lost opportunities because of this?
Just as a follow-up before you finish, I think what you raised in terms of that, you must probably start thinking about having an institution that is going to focus on innovation and development of indigenous technology. Probably you may want to help the committee by giving some ideas of how, you know, some ideas and guidelines on how the institution could be structured. You know, and then, you know, just as a guideline into what you think could be done. Because it's been a loud cry of this committee for a number of
The member's question, it goes straight to the heart of the reason why the department, brackets for whom I do not work, while the department has motivated for the establishment of the Technology Innovation Agency. It's exactly for that reason. The preparation of the business case for the TIA also drew on a small, rather informal study that tried to get a sense of those lost opportunities. That work was done by the Department of Science and Technology. And it clearly is a concern to the policy people in the department. Yes, there will always be some leakage. You cannot lock up knowledge unless you're going to lock up people. There will always be some leakage, and there will be always be cases where a local investor cannot be persuaded. It's too risky. There's a case in Cape Town, a small company called Rocket Seed, that engineered some internet security or internet advertising monitoring software. They tried to raise the funds locally, they couldn't succeed. They took it to London, they succeeded. Have they broken their links completely with South Africa? Apparently not. So it's difficult to keep the stable door completely locked. And the TIA, and that would certainly be work for this committee, the TIA has as one of its objectives to try to address the very problem that you're raising. The question from the chair, what kind of institution are we thinking about? I can't answer that in the time we've got left. It's a much bigger issue. But we have a fairly well distributed, geographically distributed set of higher education institutions, the Northern Cape being the exception. You've got Univen out there. You've got Fort Hare where it is. You've got Stellenbosch in the middle of the Rhineland. In the days of
white agri business, I suppose what it was, what it might still be, you had an intimate connection between the needs of the farmer, the research institutes, and the universities. It worked. And that's why my comment about food security, that's what I'm referring to. We were able to grow enough, we might not be able to afford to buy it. That's another issue. So if one thinks about an agency for rural development, and particularly technology transfer, I would base it on the universities that are in the deep rural areas. That's number one. Number two, I would link it with institutions, state institutions that are already there, like the ARC that is well distributed around the country. I would not make it a bureaucracy down the road, down Schoolman Street somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's got to be close to where the delivery's got to happen, so that the research staff in particular actually get dust between their toes. If they sit too far away, they won't know what it's about. It has to be embedded.
I think
You allow me a body break for 5 minutes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Professor, and whilst you're still here, I wanted to find out something. Now, this relates to the concept knowledge system. Now, the concept knowledge system, it means the whole system, in my own view, together. But I've noticed that South Africa, at least the ones, the people who are doing research and who are doing innovation, have not as yet accepted the concept that there is knowledge out there from the communities we have been talking about now, which we have commented on. There is knowledge out there, and that knowledge is equal to any other knowledge, except that knowledge is not known by many, because it hides there where the people have been isolated, and that people have not as yet gotten into their own mind where that knowledge is. In fact, there is a bit of a undermining the fact that knowledge can actually be part of the system. That's where I was going to, part of the system of knowledge. And I have come across foreign people who have come to our country going around looking for that knowledge. And in no time, I'm very clear that they will actually be able to tap into that knowledge, go abroad, and then resell it to us. That's been my problem. So your comment doesn't really have to be a policy matter. Just to find out from you where it is experience, as what do we do with that? My chairperson here has mentioned the China and India, in terms of, they have gone to tap into that knowledge, and they are making a lot of good advances. I just wanted for my interest, what is happening around that? Thank you.
The point is well made. If you go to the last page of the presentation, there is a reference to indigenous knowledge systems in there. You cannot achieve success, particularly in rural development, if you ignore the indigenous knowledge systems. Your reference to India and China does point, however, to where they have an advantage over us. And it is simply that in both country cases, you have a very deep and long tradition of literacy. It is written down. Whether it is Confucian medicine or whether it is Ayurvedic practice, we're talking about 5,000 years of experience that has been codified. And that's a crucial problem that we grapple with. In conversation with Professor Ramesh Mashelkar, who heads the Indian CSIR, he acknowledges that they have the same problem we have in trying to access the knowledge that has not been written down. Their successes have been with what is already there in Sanskrit. We don't have that. So it is an ongoing challenge. And I think we perhaps underestimate just how difficult it is. Therefore, there will be a danger that exactly what you have described could occur. Ongoing problem.
Yeah, actually, I guess Honorable Napoleon is having in mind the Bushman's indigenous knowledge of the combative political code of blood, which has been explained by outsiders now as a product. Yet, this was just sat here with us for a long time, and there are many of those kinds of things. I think the last question was
geographic advantage bill. I'm sure there's still more disputes to come as long as it's been approved. Infraco, the undersea cable, the almost certain breakup of the telecom monopoly, being not a very clever psychic, I think those things are going to happen. And certainly one of the consequences will be that the cost of telecoms will come right down. And that can only be a good thing. If indeed it leads to significant job creation for call centers, which is already starting to happen, but much more importantly for back office processing, where we've got a huge financial services sector that can do it, then what you're likely to see is that that sector is going to become an increasingly important part of the economy, and it will create tens of thousands of jobs. Being the good politically correct psychic, get the cost of broadband down, we will thrive. What advantages do we have in this field? We've got the same time zone as the core countries of Europe. We are good in communicating in the universal language of English, unfortunately. And thirdly, believe it or not, we've got a very good and reliable electricity supply. One of the big problems for India is that their electricity supply is very, very erratic. And we complain that Cape Town has some problems, but it is nothing like what Mumbai has to tolerate. Their power goes out 6 times a day, if it's not a brownout. So if you want to be doing call center back office process engineering, you've got to be available 24/7, and I believe we can do all of that. So the predictions from your input, I can't tell what's going to happen with the SKA. We're up against the Australians, and the Australians are playing cards in a particular way. They have allies in certain places where we may not. So it becomes political. They've also got a very, very, very big desert, which we don't have. So they don't have to have a geographic advantage still, because nothing moves in the central desert. There's nothing. So it is quite a challenge to win that one, and maybe we will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think really your coming here was very, very, very useful to the committee members. I think we have learned a lot, actually, in particular, having about thinking around the poverty alleviation implementation project rather than planning project implementation. But before I finish, let me introduce Eric. Before I think you have a very, very exclusive luck and advantage to meet the Chairperson, Godfrey Oliphant, Honorable Godfrey Oliphant. As we're just talking about the geographic bill, we were together in the strategic committee. We will be having a debate, not a debate, probably the presentation in the National Assembly to finalize to advance some advantage than what Australia already has done. But I would like Honorable Oliphant probably to just introduce himself to you before, to all members actually, because
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm sorry that I'm joining only now. I've had to conclude what I was doing in communication, the SABC board. We concluded about a few minutes ago. So thanks for allowing and understanding that I came late. Well, I'm learning.
Thank you. Right, I think that at this juncture we can give you. I think there was a lunch here at the restaurant in Max Building. So, but we have to put some few messages in our system just before we finish ourselves. So we'll find you there.